The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
We're joined by a man who has turned around the fortunes of An Post. When he took over the company, it was losing 12 million euro a year. Last year, it made a profit of 40 million. Before An Post, he was head of TV3, and he has also held the positions of a senior executive at Aircom and an operations director with Waterstones bookstore chain. David McRedmond, you're very welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us. How did you turn An Post around from a 12 million loss to a 40 million profit? What did you do?
Well, the real issue was this, was we could see when I went in, we had only 2 weeks cash in hand and the numbers were way worse than I expected. Immediately, we had to fix the core economics. So I went to government and I said, you've got to get rid of the price cap. We've got to put prices up. And
You got a 40%
so we put
increase
prices
in the price
up
of a stamp.
By nearly 40%. We put it up from 36%. We put it up from 72 cents to a euro. In fact, we were when I asked them to remove the price cap, and it was a legislation piece of legislation that had to go in, I said I'd put it up to 95 cents. And at the last minute, I said to our marketing people, I said, could you do a bit of market research? What difference would it make if it went to a euro? And they came back and they said, well, the people who looking at a euro said they hated it. Terrible, terrible idea. I said, what about people 95 cents? He said they hated it, thought it was a terrible idea. So we went to a euro. That made us, between 95 cents and a euro, that made us an extra 20 million.
How did you convince the government to give a nearly 40% price increase?
Otherwise, we were going into examinership. There was no choice.
Aside from the price increase on the stamp, which was hugely beneficial, in total, what was the price increase worth over 2 or 3 years to An Post?
It was worth about 60 million in the first year, about another kind of 30 to 40 million in the second year. So it was a very large part of the improvement. Now it's worth much less. And actually, most of the improvement is coming from the growth in parcels, which is phenomenal. I mean, we were pretty much out of the parcels business. And one of the first things I did when I went into An Post, I talked to various people and I talked to the unions, and I had never really worked in a union environment. And the head of the union, Stevie Fitzpatrick, he said to me, he says, David, if you're going to fix this business, you got to get back into parcels. He says, if you don't do that, we've no future. And I completely credit him.
And how important was it
to do that?
How important was that, having the unions on side? Because when it came to the plan, you're in the process of closing one of the facilities in Cork, which I think is about 200 jobs going. And then you also needed to close 153 post offices.
Yeah, it was, look,
around
it's,
the country.
It's one of the things I've learned. I'm probably a little less aggressive than I was in business. You know, it's all about collaboration and working. You know, the unions are tough. It's a tough, particularly the lead union, CWU, they're a tough union. We have tough negotiations with them. But essentially, we want the same thing, which is the business to do well.
One of the most difficult issues facing An Post over many years was the question of rural post offices. And the issue of closing, what one should close, how many should be available in rural communities, the impact that the closure of a post office can have in a rural community. You've closed 153. How did you feel about that? Was that very difficult? Did you go and talk to people about it? Did you meet them face to face and say, we need to do this?
It has been extremely, extremely tough. And not tough. It's been extremely tough because of the impact of individual communities. And if you go into a community, and there are one or two I went into and had to meet the people in that community. But on the other hand, we also knew what it was going to do, which is it was going to save the post office network. When you close a post office, 70% of the business transfers to the next one. So what we were doing by closing 153 is we were probably saving another 150. So now we've got about 950 post offices. We've a post office in every community of over 500 people. And something which I learned recently, which is an amazing statistic, we have 500 post offices where there is no bank within 5 kilometres. So, you know, we are actually the last people providing kind of human financial services in these places and human government services.
But isn't the downside of that if that human contact is so important, there are also lots of villages now that no longer have a post office and that is gone?
I think we, you know, everybody is within 15 kilometres of a post office because that's our requirement.
You're getting into banking services more and more. You've also talked about mortgage lending. Mm-hmm. On Post tried banking before through a direct joint venture. It didn't really work. Is that a recipe for losing a lot of money?
No, not at all. We're doing really well now that we've launched OnPost Money. I mean, before, to be honest, wasn't the fault of OnPost. Fortis was a Belgian bank that went bust in the crisis and shut down. No, it's vital to us. So, for example, we launched Current Account a couple of years ago. Really hard yards to get that going. That's now getting real traction, doing extremely well. We've really worked hard. And who's our customer? And our customer isn't, people think, oh, it's the elderly, really important to us. But actually our target customer is Kira. She's 35. She commutes. And that's the sort of person who, when we do our research, is really open to being with OnPost. So I think it is coming together.
Maybe Sheila, who's 75, might like to think that OnPost is there for her as well.
Sheila, who's 75, is a core customer. Absolutely. And, you know, that's the reason why we've done that work to keep as many post offices open as possible. Because people always talk about the ones you close. We did it to keep as many open as possible.
Before OnPost, you were chief executive of TV3. What's the big difference for you running those two organisations?
Scale, I think. You know, the fact that it was blood, sweat and tears in TV3. Fantastic people. Great company. But to find 5 million to build a new studio took me years to get that. But OnPost has such scale, even when it looked like we had no money, we can still invest 20 million to build a parcel centre. So instead of doing 2,000 parcels an hour, we can do 14,000 parcels an hour.
To some extent, when you went into OnPost, the company was going through a difficult period. You know, you were looking that down the barrel of possible examinership. In a way, when you went into TV3, Doughty Hanson had bought the company. It was the height of the boom. Everybody felt corporately invincible. It must have seemed like this is going to be easy. And then the crash came, and if anything, the owners had overpaid for it. So you were the one who had to try and make it work then.
I hadn't thought of that before. It's a fascinating point. It is the opposite to OnPost. I went in and I knew the first year and a half in TV3 could do nothing wrong. Advertising, we could not take the advertising that advertisers wanted. We were absolutely full and we put our prices up and we still couldn't take more. And then the recession happened, and immediate happened faster and quicker and further than any other sector. So it was incredibly tough times. There were compulsory redundancies. It was a very tough period. But, you know, one of my proudest days in TV3 was 4 years later. I mean, in 2013, I actually remember Mark Cagney was there and saying to him, I said, and this big crowd in our newsroom, and I said, the recession is over, because we said we'd restore pay and we got our pay back to the level. Then we had to move very fast, because what happened next was UTV then said they were going to launch. And that was one of the worst days of my career, driving to work, hearing that we were losing all the ITV programming to UTV. And I had to stand up in front of the staff again, who had just said the recession is over. And I'm going,
the recession's back on.
So I'd actually, what I said, I remember saying to them, I said, we'll win this. We will win this. And we did, you know.
And the company was sold. Did you enjoy that time in TV3? What was it like working with in the media industry with egos and personalities and making programs like California as well?
Yeah, I know, California will go down in my as
were
one
you
of
a
my
fan?
Great.
Did you watch it?
California, yeah, of course I was a fan. I was a fan of everything we did. I was proud of everything we did. I loved it. I mean, it's, look, you know, programming is television's interesting because it's not for you. It's for your viewers, and it's for their lives, and it's for what fits into their lives at certain times. Do I watch Love Island? No. Do I respect Love Island's program? Hell yes. You know, that's what you do. So as regards, look, there's egos everywhere. There's egos in business. There's egos in, I'm sure there's egos in journalism. And there's egos in show business. And I enjoyed it. You know, I always talk about, for example, Vincent Brown, who was so important to TV3. He really, through the recession, he really saved us. You know, TV3 made its money from Ireland AM and Vincent Brown. You know, those were the slots that we won. RT would win the other slots. We won those slots. And somebody like Vincent, you know, you'd have arguments with him, but it was all about a passion for the programme, all about it, usually because he wanted the programme to be 3 hours long and start at 9 in the evening.
Did you ever win any of those arguments?
No, or
did
I lost all of them, I think. I'm glad to say he's a friend and it will always be one of the most remarkable programmes in Irish television will have been The Tonight Show with Vincent Brown.
Now, going back, media was very much in the blood, it was in the family. Your dad was the youngest editor of the Irish Independent, right, Louis McGredmond. Do you remember as a kid when he was in that job?
Funnily,
go into Abbey Street?
Yeah, I do remember it because I'm literally around the corner now in the GPO, and I have this memory from probably the age of 6 or 7, walking out to the clock. There was a little gantry out to the clock.
That's the big clock on Middle Abbey Street.
The big clock on Middle Abbey Street. And I was walking by the building the other day and saying, God, I'd love if that building was done up again. It's a beautiful building, beautiful facade, and it's empty, I think. It'd be a fantastic newspaper office. Maybe I&M could go there.
So growing up, what was it like then, having your dad as this very prominent figure in journalism? Did that affect conversations at the dinner table? Did it affect how you were educated, what you thought about the world and what you wanted to do?
Well, I always say, yeah, that was my father and great intellect, and I'm very proud of that heritage. But there was also my mother, who is a teacher, and she had to really keep doing the work because my father kept taking newspapers up market and then had to move on to another job or something. All the time my mother would be teaching. So I guess it was quite an intellectual household, or certainly there was plenty of debate around the table. And believe it or not, I was the quiet one.
you went to UCD and you studied history.
Yeah.
At that time, were you thinking the media, or were you
business? I always wanted to be a journalist. I was dead set on being a journalist. I went to London and applied for jobs like editor of The Guardian or The Times, or a producer in the BBC. And of course, I wasn't going to get remotely qualified. And I ran out of money pretty quickly. And I got a job in a bookstore. And it was one of the first Waterstones bookstores which opened. And that turned out to be a very, very lucky move for me. And met Tim Waterstone, a remarkable entrepreneur, a great businessman, very charismatic man. And between a group of us, we built it up into the biggest book chain in Europe. And at that stage, it was almost like the internet.
What was your first job then? When you went into Waterstones, it was a relatively new company. Mm. They only had a couple of outlets.
My job was in a bookstore in Regent Street on the shop floor. But immediately you were put in charge of the history section. So I'd buy the books that we'd sell. And I had great fun then. I remember Colm Tobin at that stage had just written A Walk Along the Border, which was one of the first books I promoted and pushed it. And that gave me such a feel for that great interface between really journalism or writing and marketing and business. And I love that mix.
And then you went to the US. You were there for a few years.
I opened Waterstones in the US. I opened it in Boston, which was a huge success and did extremely well. And then I opened it in Chicago, which was a disaster because I made some fundamental mistakes. Well, the big mistake I made was I didn't want to pay the rent on North Michigan Avenue, so I opened it just around the corner. Now, you can do that in Ireland or UK. You can't do it in a city like Chicago because people are not going to go 20 yards down the wrong street. That could be a dangerous move. And so literally that was a big mistake. But, you learn from those and you move on. But you've got a 25-year lease, so you're either stuck with it or you find your way around it. And look, one of the things I've learned in business is not to be too afraid of the mistakes. Just learn to deal with them quickly.
Now, in Ireland, after that, you became a senior executive in Aircom at a time after it was privatised and it was bought out. It was floated on the stock market. It was bought out by private equity. There was a lot of change taking place in the company at that time. Do you think when you look back, and I know you're chair of Air today, but when you look back at that time, were a lot of mistakes made that affected the company in the long term? There were a lot of people financially milking that business?
I think that, look, the story of, I can't remember who it was who said, was the outcome of the French Revolution a good outcome? He says, no, it's too soon to say. The history of Aircom will be written and of Air, and I'm back in as the chairman of Air now. I'm very proud. I think it's a fantastic company and I think it's done great things. I can't say what, sure, I'm absolutely sure there were big mistakes made and decisions that were wrong. But whatever happened is it meant it was in private equity hands very quickly. Now, I'm a big fan of private equity. Private equity is very focused. There's no prejudices. It's just about making money. And that can sometimes be a good thing because, you know, you run a business well, you should be able to make money and get it to work. But I think it wasn't ready for it. And I think, you know, so I think it was a very hard period. But also,
was it that hard, though, David? In a sense, surely it was easy. The company had a monopoly ownership of the main telecommunications network. Debt was cheap. It could run off and borrow, shed loads of money, pay out to shareholders and executives multi-million euro in pay and shares and bonuses. The staff had a slice of it, and in total, the employee share trust bagged over half a billion. And somewhere along the way, as customers and consumers, it was being underinvested, and we ended up with a deficit in our broadband, particularly in rural broadband.
Yeah, I think you say it had a monopoly, but of course you have a regulator, and you had regulated prices that were below cost. So it was a simple enough economic piece for an investor. When I say private equity, it's rational, and you're being told, well, look, do you want to invest 1 euro, but you'll only get 70 cent back? No, I don't, you know? And that's
but
a constant battle in most places.
Trousering money all over the place. If you're saying that the regulator didn't allow a proper investment case, so therefore it wouldn't have brought a suitable return, the place was awash with money. It just seemed to be going in one direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think where the company was at fault, too slow in broadband, absolutely. And, you know, it was pretty clear that broadband was the future. But it was a big battle, quite interestingly, at the time around, was broadband the future or mobile? And of course, the answer was both.
One of the things that OnPost makes the headlines for in relation to RTE, this organisation, is the question of the licence fee and collecting the licence fee. And there's been a lot of criticism of the level of cooperation that's there from individuals and how much remains uncollected. The government has said that they're going to put it out, I think, to tender again at some point in the future. Why aren't more people paying it?
You might ask yourself, why are 88% of people paying it? You know, because 88% of people pay the license fee, and they pay it because because you're supposed to. If you have a television, you're supposed to pay the license fee, and you should do. And hopefully they see that they get value for it. You go around
Could you do more
estates
in OnPost?
And knock on the door and say, pay the license fee. I think we've done phenomenally in OnPost. You know, we have increased, license fee revenues have increased, certainly over the past 3 years, each year. Now, that's at a time when RT's commercial revenues have gone down very dramatically. You look in the UK, for example, and they're talking about, should the BBC be a subscription-only model? I think there needs to be a new model. Is there going to be a license fee in 30 years' time? You know, I think you'd say no. Is it going to be there in 20 years' time? Probably unlikely. You know, and you work your way back from that and you realise you better come up with a new model soon.
As someone who started out after college interested in journalism, is RTE and taking on running RTE something that would interest you? You applied for the director-general's job the last time. What happened there?
I don't know. I mean, they didn't. I mean, I met the headhunters, terribly nice, and I know them, and they were interested, I think. But they said, look, the board weren't. They felt I hadn't the program making experience. It was probably California put them off or something like that. never mind that I'd built a studio and Vincent Brown and all of those pieces. But look, that's
is that
fine.
A bit of
I'd
unfinished know, business for you? Yeah,
well,
do you think
no,
at some
I know,
point in the future.
Well, firstly,
like
I had no entitlement to the job, and D Forbes, fantastic experience and international experience, and so do others, and plenty of others, good people going for it. I think I probably should have got an interview, but that's a different matter. Is it unfinished business? Look, I'd love at some stage, you know, I've still work to do it on PUST. It's very important we complete the transformation we're going through, and I want to do that. But yeah, at some stage, I'd love to get back into media. RTE is a big media beast, and I think it's really interesting. But no, it's not. I'm not out there looking to get into RTE. And you know, there's certainly maybe once you've done one big job for the state, maybe you've done that piece.
And for OnPost, do you want to stay much longer with OnPost?
Yeah, I want to. I certainly want to see this. You know, I went in saying I would do this transformation. I told the unions I would do it. I told the staff I would do it. And I really, really believe in it. I think we're very substantially down the road with it. You know, we had a 200 million gap to close because each year the fall off in revenues from letters falls by 30 million a year. So actually the gap we've closed, we were due to lose 110 million this year. We'll actually make 40 million. So that's 150 million of turnaround that the staff have delivered. And I'm really proud that they've done that.
When running a business and facing up to a lot of financial challenges, having to let people go, downsize the business, as it's often referred to, is that something that gives you sleepless nights? Is it something that you just feel you're paid to do? How do you feel about that?
You know, intellectually, it's you cope with it. It's actually, you know, it's straightforward. You look at it and you see what it does, and you look at when I say the balance sheet, not the numbers, but you look at the benefits and you say, look, this is better because it's better. It retains other jobs, retains high class jobs. And one of the things we're very committed to is decent work, not having gig economy, not having 0 hour contracts. But that means, you know, you have to be efficient. And so it's very easy to do it rationally. Of course, it takes a human toll. And, you know, I was in the Cork Mail Centre and people were devastated. And that's a very, it's not as tough on me as it is on them. But yeah, there is that can wear.
If you had to describe your own management style, what would you say it was?
You know, my management style, it probably has changed. You know, I'm certainly very direct. I think I'm hard to work for. I'm direct. I'm
quite demanding.
You
think you're a bit less aggressive than you used to be. What do you mean by that?
Well, I tell you what it is. Aggressive is not a word I'd like, and I use that word myself. But I think I certainly realise you don't have to win every battle. Sometimes you just have to build the relationships more, understand, you know, that people have different agendas or different interests, and you have to work with those interests a bit and get more collaborative. And I think you can deliver change that way. You know, it's the make haste slowly sometimes. You can move too fast and too hard.
David McRenmond, Chief Executive of On Post, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.